Yes, very good question. So I think everyone can... Are you okay hearing me without the microphone?
Yeah.
So... Okay. So the answer to the question is the different species of malaria that exist. So we have multiple species. I'm hesitating because traditionally there's four, but in the last couple of years there's been a fifth found in humans. So we thought it was only in certain monkeys, but it seems to have now transferred to humans. So let's say there's five. Anyway, only one of them, the Plasmodium vivax, is the one that can hibernate in the liver. And that leads to those stories of years later, my grandfather, after the war, came down with bouts of malaria again, because it hides in the liver for months and or even years, and for no reason that we fully understand, decides to pop back out again and circulate the blood, and hence that's the clinical symptoms. So, we don't give them vivax, is the answer. We know that vivax can do that and can hang around, so we give them a known lab-reared strain of malaria, which is completely susceptible to chloroquine. And so as soon as they show any signs, they immediately get treated with chloroquine. Although some of them really soldier on and say, no, I'm feeling fine, it's working as well, even though they're sweating, they've clearly got fever. So yeah, they're their own worst enemies. But I hope that answers.
Use my privilege a bit. Can you discuss different kinds of trials? You hear things like double-blind and single-blind trials being bandied around. What do they mean?
Okay, so, yeah, there's lots of different trials. So blinding is about how many people know who's getting which drug. So if you have a single-blinded trial, if I'm trying to get this right, then the person receiving the drug doesn't know what they're getting. If you have it double-blinded, the person receiving and the person prescribing doesn't know. So you just have A and B labels, boxes that look exactly the same. The formulations need to look exactly the same. It can't be done in all cases because sometimes the drugs look different and so on. And obviously in a vaccine trial, it's quite hard sometimes in the early stages to either know you're getting a vaccine or not, but sometimes you're comparing a piece of sugar, water or something. And then placebo-controlled, which is another term that's used in trial, is where you're comparing the drug you're testing against a placebo, a sugar pill. But in the latter stages of testing, we wouldn't justify, we can't justify ethically giving somebody a sugar pill versus a new antimalarial. So they have to get the standard policy of that country in which you're recruiting versus your new drug.
Yep, people at the back. Will George go over there and then behind you as well?
I just wanted to say, who's winning?
Well, I'm a malariologist, so I think malaria is so clever. It's constantly outwitting us. I mean, no, that's not fair. We're doing a really good job. Actually, the last few years, with a bit of will, goodwill, a bit of political will, a lot of money from Bill Gates, via Microsoft Windows. It is coming down. It's really coming down. But you know, there's some real tough spots geographically where it's just there's parts of Tanzania where I lived where you can get an infectious bite every night of the year. So what we use a term for like the number of infectious bites per year that anyone could be exposed to within a certain geographical place, and there it's 365. So you could, you know, yeah, it's going to be hard, you know, to really get the numbers down when you're in that kind of level of transmission. But on the fringes, it, you know, the map's getting smaller, and some countries are going for eradication. So there's a lot of hope and drive that we're going to do. We've got a lot of tools, actually. Sorry, I'm going on and on. Should be more people talking.
Far side, and then we'll go to the back.
My question is, where are we at with malaria vaccine?
Yeah, okay. It's a good question. It's absolutely one of the tools that we need. Everyone agrees in the research community that we're going to need everything we can. The answer is about 5 years, probably, until we can actually use it in the field. When I was in Tanzania, we were doing phase 3 of the best vaccine at the moment available. So it's a big trial. It's 16,000 kids. We're not all in Tanzania, but across the world. It's about 45% effective. So it's nothing like some of the brilliant vaccines that have wiped out diseases. But you know, you're talking about nearly a million kids every year dying. Then you know,
effective for how long?
Right, so at the moment the data is follow-up of 2 years, so you know we've only got that amount of follow-up period from those kids that first got the vaccine, so they're just going to be washed. But the real thing is that they don't die. They can get malaria, they can be a bit sick, but as long as they're cutting off that death toll, then I think it's, you know, it's worth it.
So growing up in India, we were kind of told that Vivax is the most prevalent strain. I don't know how outdated this information
right.
is. But having just heard that most of the tests is on non-Vivax strains, I just want to ask a kind of maybe selfish question, that how much of an overlap in drug susceptibility do you see with Vivax versus the strains which you actually test for?
Right. Oh, it's a good question. Vivax is still susceptible to a lot of the drugs we have. There's debate at the moment. We were just having it at work last week with one of our clinical scientists who wants to do more studies on chloroquine resistance in Vivax. So chloroquine, which is really useless against falciparum now, is you know, possibly still okay against Vivax. And the other thing with Vivax is you want a drug that kills the stage that rests in the liver, and there's one drug that can do that, primaquine. So that's always used in cases with Vivax. They would always combine it with that drug as well. I don't really know probably the answers actually about the resistance, but it's an open area. And actually, the problem is not enough people work on Vivax is really the answer, because it doesn't kill people. It's still a bad disease, but because it doesn't kill, there's just been less research on that area, more research on that.
Morbidity is still pretty bad.
Right, it's still bad, yeah, totally.
Am I right in thinking that there's one advantage, though, which is that the mouse models, they can't be affected by falciparum, but they can be by Vivax. So when you're testing mice, you're actually testing against that more, even though then it's harder to do the studies in humans afterwards.
Certainly with Vivax, I don't actually know about the mouse models we have, but in Vivax, we can't grow Vivax in the test tube, basically. We haven't ever been able to culture it. In which we can in falciparum. So it's another reason why there's a lot of research done on falciparum. It's really hard. If you take the Vivax out of a human, you can't keep it going in the lab for anything more than a couple of days. So I don't know about the mouse models, but you may be right.
We were developing at the left-hand stage, trying to do lead optimization. We could basically test in vitro against falciparum, but then all the models, the only thing you could possibly test against was Vivax, so that's where I'm getting that from.
Right, okay.
Admittedly 10 years ago, but I don't think it's too out of date. But in a way, that's probably a good thing, so you're getting it exposed to both as it goes through.
So, is it possible to conduct some
aware
research on Vivax in developing countries?
Can you just repeat that, Georgian?
About to prevent this selecting infections.
So,
In our country, it is really hazardous for most of the kids and other people. They are just suffering in the area from most of the years. But people are very poor and they don't have any awareness about the vaccine or other important drugs. They are just using the basic plant like cinchona or any other to treat malaria. So is there any possibility to conduct some awareness programs in developing countries so that people can know that these vaccines, they can use for the treatment of this disease?
Yeah, so the question for anyone that didn't hear was about awareness campaigns, just generally in endemic countries. there is a lot of work on that. There's a lot of social science studies that are conducted. There's also economic studies. Like, there's a lot of private sector actually involvement in the treatment and prevention of malaria. Like, people can go to their corner shop and buy a bed net themselves, or they can buy old chloroquine or old ST. It's still really cheap, and it's prevalent, even though, you know, the official drug policy of the country might be that that drug shouldn't be used there. So there are a lot of campaigns. There are some, you know, top-down national campaigns, but it's generally up to the national malaria program in each country as to what they do, and that can vary dramatically as depending on what their health budget is and where they see their priorities. So,
what's Tanzania doing that's wrong?
So you're starting from a very high transmission area. So you've got to do a lot with very high coverage of everywhere to have an impact. And that costs a lot of money. And, you know, the health budget in Tanzania for each person is about $2-3 a year. So, you know, one course of artemisinin combination therapy drug dose is $1-2. So, you know, you have to start thinking about where you're going to divide up your money.
In the old days, they used to spray DDT.
Right.
And that was very good, actually.
So, yeah, there are spraying campaigns. They're doing it in tablet. I should say, I mean, actually, there's parts of Tanzania, if we use that as an example, that are pretty successful. There's been really intensive control measures on Zanzibar, partly because of the huge tourist industry there. So they're really going for eradication on the island, and also because it's an island, there's a certain amount of ease of control. So they're doing spraying. They're going around spraying indoor residual spraying inside people's houses, also going around spraying pools of water and larvicide. And they're doing active case follow-up, so they're trying to really find any one case and treat them as quickly as possible. And you know, numbers are coming right down. So DDT is a bit complicated because it's pretty horrific organic matter, and now people didn't want to carry on using it. It's been banned. It hung around in the environment for a long time. So there are others. There are other sprays being used, but it is hard. I mean, people were actually spraying from planes across, you know, huge vast areas of Africa for a period of time in the 50s on the eradication campaign, and it was just so difficult. Mosquito is really successful, and the parasites are really successful.
This is a large-scale release of sterile mosquitoes at Bronson Avenue. And the second question was drugs, sort of drugs you buy from the chemist to go and hold it there.
Yeah.
Are they the same classes of drugs? And that's the same consideration for that.
I'll start with the drug. Prophylaxis is different in the sense that the dosing is different. You're maintaining a small level of the drug in your blood, and you have to start taking it, you know, 1 week before you go, so you just maintain that level.
Sorry, prophylaxis,
taking a drug as a preventative measure rather than a treatment dose, which all these are really about treatments. I don't know actually enough about I'm not a clinician, so I'm going to put my hands up on that one. I don't know enough about the different prophylaxis drugs.
Can I chip in? They are the same, yeah. And you shouldn't just go to the chemist. You definitely need to have a discussion about where exactly you're going, right down to the exact area, because even in some countries, the prevalence of different things can vary, and the WHO advices can vary.
Yes.
So that's fine as long as your chemist is willing to have a proper long conversation about it.
Oh, yes, certainly that's true. In terms of resistance.
Does resistance develop as rapidly to those as it does to the...
It doesn't develop rapidly in tourists, so we're not seen as a threat. So the ideal thing to do is for tourists to take prophylaxis, because then we're not going to come down with it and we won't be a problem. And we disappear out of country, so there's no opportunity for the malaria to develop resistance. So things which are starting to tail off in terms of the population can be used as prophylaxis for years and years longer, which is, and particularly his combination therapies, which is why they work. So you're going to find that you'll prescribe things which you may then come across a report saying this is no longer used for first-line treatment. And it wouldn't be in somebody who lives in the country and gets ill, but it does work as prophylactic because it's going to reduce the chance of you getting seriously ill right down. So that's how that works. It extends the lifetime of the drug a little bit, actually, which is quite useful. But there are still some that you can't take any longer because it simply doesn't work. Because the resistance strain is now, you know, virtually 100% in the country, and therefore any bite it would work on. So the general principles are saying that.
Yeah, generally some of the first line prophylactic treatments that your GP would recommend here are so prohibitively expensive for using as treatments in the endemic countries that the parasites are not exposed to those very much at all. So yeah, resistance like Malarone would cost several, well, £1 a day or £2 a day, but they're never going to use that in Tanzania. It's not used, I think. They would develop it. And the first question was about sterile mosquitoes. Yeah. So there are some groups working on this, Keele University. And yeah, so the idea, for anyone that doesn't know, is that you release males that are sterilised into a population, male mosquitoes, sorry. you release them and then they compete with the local male population, but obviously with the idea that you just reduce the mosquito population. So far, there are a few problems. One is that the sterile males definitely have a fitness cost, so it seems like they can't compete very well against the, if you like, the wild male population, which is crucial for that to work. And secondly, obviously there's some resistance in the population. Sort of ethically, is this sensible to release genetically modified organisms? So there's a lot more testing needs to be done. There's some interesting, what we call semi-field sites, which are like giant netted greenhouses, where we can release in a, you know, fairly large scale and see normal-ish behaviour of the mosquitoes and see what happens. But it's really hard to transfer what we know from cages in a lab to what's really going to happen if they were released in the wild. And yeah, there's a lot of fear around releasing genetically modified organisms, you know, maybe rightly so. So I don't know if it's really going to take off.
What's called hearts here? Because that's been available. And that is a parasitic.
It is a parasitic.
And that's got been gone completely.
Yes.
Has it? It's. Good. Well, you never hear about that.
That's not the same as gone completely. It's a parasite whose second host is a water snail.
And there are various different types.
Yeah. I don't know if it's gone completely. It may well have come out of a particular place.
But it's certainly reduced.
Not as successful as a mosquito, I suspect.
I'm not
as
confident.
But it's another parasitic illness.
It is, yeah. I think you can. It's got to do with either filtering the water or not swimming. And
yeah. So people don't swim in water as much.
I mean, can't infect the water. They can't put chemicals into the water to stop this mosquito.
Somebody once pointed out when I was at a malaria conference that, you know, mosquito can breed millions of itself in the water collected in the fold of a crunched up Coke can when it's just rained, and it's stagnant water and the pool is a teaspoonful, and that's enough for a female mosquito to breed millions of itself over a couple of weeks. That's the problem. You know, you look in a place the size of this room and outside there are so many places where little tiny pools of stagnant water can come. You're going to treat all of those? How do you do that? You know, it's almost unthinkable, even something the size of this room, let alone a massive great country. So I think that's the problem with the idea of just treating water.
You can't.
It has been very effective. I mean, we don't have malaria in Italy, and as well as replacing well water.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, yeah. And so taking away, you know, the more kind of stagnant pool areas around rivers has helped. But it's also a slightly temperature thing. There is some thought that malaria may come back more to Europe as global warming takes effect.
Well, Italy is still a lot warmer than we are here. So we've got a long way to go.
Will, George, go.
That's okay, I can shout. With the bed net kind of that must be quite difficult actually to make sure that there's a significant coverage of the population actually using bed nets. What's the kind of approach to that? I mean, that must be difficult to do in rural communities.
Yeah, it is. And there's been different models experimented with, like either giving them away or actually selling them, because sometimes when people bought them, even for a small amount, they value them more and then kind of looked after it. And then there's also a question of longevity. So the insecticide is impregnated on the bed net, and people of course take them down and wash them, and then it gradually washes off over time. So there's a kind of lifespan of 3 to 5 years of a bed net, and also they get holes in. So there's a kind of have to like constantly replenish as well. The bed net story is one of real success, actually. There's been absolutely millions and millions of bed nets distributed. Really good campaigns. In Tanzania, the coverage is incredibly high in kids and pregnant women. So they're really targeted. If you come with a child to a clinic, then you get a bed net. If you take part in any trial, you get a bed net. And the places where trials are repeatedly taking place, I mean, literally 100% of the population is sleeping in a bed net. The interesting thing, I think, about some of the studies on bed nets is that the mosquitoes are actually changing their behaviour. So now we're seeing, of course, the bed net only really works if the malaria-carrying mosquito only bites at sleeping time.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing is those mosquitoes are constantly coming up against bed nets, and so they start biting a bit earlier before you go to bed. So now we're seeing biting behaviour changing in the mosquito population. So it's always just trying, it's evolving organisms all the time, you know, so we're trying to keep ahead of that.
With kids, where if you can prevent them getting malaria too early, is their immune system then developed enough that if they receive getting that later, they're more likely to not die in childhood, which is what you're saying is a big problem?
Yeah, that is a really good question. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So there's a kind of curve of where you've had lots of interventions, you get the biggest peak of morbidity and mortality in the youngest children. But where now there's been lots of interventions and keep those under fives protected, you actually just see the curve shifting to slightly older.
So they're not immune, and
so they acquire immunity over a longer period of time, where it shifts. So I think the overall figures on deaths still decrease. So it's still, but there's a lot of debate about that area actually. Whether
it just shifts the time of it,
right? Successful, yeah. And hence why maybe the lesson is you don't just target everything in under fives, which is what we've done. And we need to think about the whole population. There's a lot of studies on mass treatments as well, which was also part of the 50s eradication campaign. So going into a village and just giving everybody a dose once a year, that looks really successful, because you just take the edge off all the kids in one school carrying parasites.
Yes, your map earlier showed Straits of Gibraltar as being a sort of cut-off point for the malaria mosquito. And,
right.
And I wonder whether that's actually true, but presumably, for all intents and purposes, it is true. But I spend a lot of time in Spain, so and I hear these mosquitoes going around, and I wonder sometimes whether I need to do something a little bit more to protect myself. But the other thing is it not possible for the non-malarial mosquitoes to interbreed with the others, and therefore is there not going to be a transfer of malaria into Europe that way? I'm surprised it's never happened.
We're definitely reaching the limits of my knowledge here, which is good. Let's challenge each other. You don't get cross reproduction between the mosquito species.
Right.
Yeah, so you wouldn't get an anopheles mating with a Culex. That's never been seen. But whether you mean maybe the parasite can now start being carried by a different species of mosquito. Again, it's never been seen. I mean, these parasite-host relationships are thought to have developed over millennia. I mean, basically, there's evidence that, you know, we were living with malaria and those a lot of these mosquitoes were transmitting it in 2000 BC, much earlier back, probably. So it takes a long time for those successful relationships to evolve.
But what one wonders why it is, because I mean in Spain the climate and is really very similar. So you wonder why it is there.
I mean, basically, the answer is the simple answer is that malaria is a disease of poverty, and so if you increase sanitation, you increase your healthcare access to healthcare systems. You have quick, efficient treatments. People don't have to, you know, walk 2 days to get to it. And they also...
And patient houses.
Right, sealed houses. There's so many measures that as, you know, economic, socioeconomic status increases, it just inevitably comes with it. I mean, that would be my argument more than an environmental issue.
I mean, equally, according to that, doesn't get to Central America in the place of poverty.
Yeah.
It's not quite true anyway. I was going to just
I should preface it's about data, available data.
There's malaria in the southern states of the USA.
There is.
Which the Caribbean?
Some, but not as much as in Florida, where they spray every night.
Florida
during the summer. Yeah. So malaria is in Florida to a sufficient extent that they spray every night during the summer. And that's a great cocktail. I've no idea. It's exercise killing mosquitoes. There's kind of an hour in the evening when they go around spraying. Yeah. So everyone knows to nip inside and shut the doors and windows. But it's good news because that's why it's an orphan disease in America. An orphan disease is one that affects less than, I think, it's 0.3% of the population, which malaria does. It gets a massive tax rebate for research into it. So it makes it worth it for pharmaceutical companies and the institutes to investigate, so it becomes a good idea. And without that, it wouldn't have been half the money pumped into malaria in developing countries. So it's probably a good thing.
Can mosquitoes carry AIDS?
No. There's no evidence that I know of that there was any transmission of HIV through mosquitoes. They can't survive through... Well, when you think about it... I was trying to explain the complexity of the route that the malaria parasite has to take. You imagine the mosquito takes in blood, it goes into their gut. You then have to get back out again all the way into the salivary glands to get out into the next person, and HIV doesn't make that journey. It's quite a convoluted journey. You've got to cross lots of barriers of different cell membranes.
It changes form, doesn't it? 21 times in total through the whole cycle? So.
Oh, the malaria parasite, yeah.
Can you tell us about the very first phases of drug selection? Are we now stuck with drugs that have been selected in the first phase and they're the only ones now progressing into later phases? Next question is, on what basis do they select in the very first stages? Do they think of a compound and say, well, this may work, let's try it? There's an infinite number of compounds they could try.
Yeah.
Are there still more to be found?
let's hope so. So the first question, we're constantly trying to feed the pipeline from the very beginning and keep compounds progressing through that cycle. So we're not just stuck at any one point. I would hope that there's always going to, there's still money in the early stages of research and development on new compounds. There is a push to try and speed up the whole process by piggybacking on the back of existing drugs for other diseases. So that speeds up things a lot, because if you find that a drug that is actually developed for, you know, some skin complaint suddenly can be used for another disease, then you've got a lot of data on the safety of that drug already, and it can speed the process. So there's one area that they're targeting. But in terms of which compounds you pick, I mean, basically now there are huge libraries of compounds, and it's just a question of screening against these libraries. So you just start with, I mean, you can do robotic screening of thousands of compounds against whatever your disease of interest is. And yeah, there are still like medicinal local herbs, extracts that are still popping up, where suddenly somebody says, well, I found this works, and has been using it for years, and there's still things that we haven't looked at before. So I'm hoping that there's always new things that can come along.
What type of compounds you are using for these trials? Like, is it natural powders or synthetic compounds?
So, good question. The libraries are synthetic, so where you have like screening libraries, and they're all developed by medicinal chemists. But smaller trials look at the early stages of extracts. I mean, there are certain groups that concentrate often on trying to identify new plants that have been used by people, but it's not. It's a tricky one, because you don't want to end up in a situation where you found something that really works, but it takes 10 years to scale up growing all of these plants to get enough for the global market. So obviously synthetically produced chemicals can be scaled up much more easily, so it's easier to use a synthetic.
What
do
you want to chip in?
Yeah.
I was going to say that, so the whole which drug shall we decide to develop?
Which drug should we decide to develop? Question. It's not a completely random process. People are having a go at trying to make sensible decisions about which particular biological targets to try and inhibit. So a lot of what goes on up the hill at the Structural Genomics Consortium is trying to classify different proteins known to be involved in various diseases, including malaria. And they'll say, right, we know this protein is involved with this particular disease. Can we drug it? Let's find bits of it that we can try and stick molecules to and try and inhibit its behaviour. This is a very difficult process. It doesn't often work, but it's trying to be targeted in the approach of searching for new drug compounds rather than just randomly screening the, as you say, the infinite number of chemicals that we can possibly look for.
Can I chip in as well? So Will, myself, Anna, and Jess, we're all chemists, actually, so that these poor souls get involved in this, because I teach them and wheedle them to come and help. And for us, there isn't really a distinction between synthetic and natural, except how you've made it. And one of the molecules down here, artemisinin, is a massively good example of that. So it was known in Chinese herbal medicine, and it's very strong antimalarial. It was used for years in China, I mean, thousands of years probably in China. And obviously the secret, if you like, kind of very slowly crept out post-World War II. And there was a group of scientists who were in America, USA, where malaria, as well as for Florida, but also for their troops going overseas, there's been a very, very large amount of investment to try and develop new drugs to protect them. And they said, well, this is fantastic. But this wretched plant, you know, how are we going to grow it? People tried to cultivate it, didn't seem to work. And then somebody spotted that it was exactly the same plant that was growing as a weed outside the back of their house, really locally. So they realised that actually you need to not look after it in the lab, but let it grow in sandy soil, and it works fine. Developed lots of, you know, bred up plant and started extracting, and they discovered through a very slow process that that molecule was the active ingredient, at which point it switched to trying to make it in a lab. This happened around the time that I was finishing up my postdoc in this. It's quite exciting when suddenly somebody managed to publish a full synthesis of that drug, which is very hard to make. And the reason it's so good is that it doesn't develop resistance particularly fast. It's got two, if you look at the structure, it's got two little red bits side by side, which is a peroxide bridge. And that falls apart if it circulates around the body for more than about a day or two. So if it gets absorbed into cells, it works against the malaria parasite, and then it falls apart, so you don't develop resistance. So then now we can make artemisinin. We don't need to grow the plant anymore. It's exactly the same active ingredient. We don't need to extract it from lots of plants. There are lots and lots of drugs like that where the first work is done in herbal medicine. We know it works. We've got to find out which bit works, because there are millions of different molecules in the plant. Once we've worked out which one, then we can try and make it. That takes another few years. Once you've worked out how to make it, scale it up, big production, then you can start testing it in the pure form. But to all intents and purposes, that's the same stuff that's been in Chinese herbal medicine for years. The only difference is we haven't got all the other junk around it, all the other green bits out of the plant. That's the only difference. So there isn't really much distinction between them for a chemist. And that's what it then ties in back into what Will was saying, is that there are lots and lots of different things. But if we know which molecule it is and we have some idea of how it works, we can then think about how we might change that structure slightly so that the resistant version of the parasite can't bite on it, can't destroy it. Or to make it even more, work even better. Yeah, exactly.
Is it known where its site of action is in the cells?
Yes, it is. I'm not an expert on that one. I don't think it's an anti-folate. I think it's something else. But there is a particular enzyme which it inhibits. Do you know?
Is it a different site from chloroquine?
Yes, chloroquine is an anti-folate. Dihydrofolate reductase is an enzyme which is needed every time a cell replicates, and that includes a malaria parasite cell. And we have our own version, human.
Well,
and the malaria has its own version.
There was a story that artemisinin was inhibiting
calcium pump at one stage. Inhibiting? I'm not sure at all. I don't know about artemisinin. Well, it could be, it's an enzyme in the cascade for the calcium pump, if that's the case. So it's an enzyme inhibitor. I just don't know which one.
In the first two trials, you said that you take healthy volunteers and give them malaria and a drug, but it doesn't really seem very ethical to me. Why can't you just take volunteers that already have malaria and then test the drug on them?
Right.
Because that's done with other drugs and other diseases.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's a question of location where the trials take place. So obviously if we're talking about European drug development, then you're not going to be able to recruit volunteers with malaria. The challenge, and this is genuinely the situation, has been that there are just very few locations in malaria endemic countries that were capable of conducting those kind of studies. They needed certain levels of facilities and health infrastructure. In the Far East, in Southeast Asia, that's true. But there's only a handful of places in Africa that were capable of conducting phase two trials, because you need to have so many facilities on hand, so many certain machinery to do testing. If anything went wrong, as kind of all the eventualities. I know there was discussions when I was in Tanzania about conducting phase two trials, and they still didn't have the level of facilities that one would require for European phase two level testing. So I think that's the answer. The infrastructure was there. Ideally, of course, you would want to test on those that were just coming in with malaria anyway and say, do you want to take part in this trial? Okay, you can get the test drug versus
were there any difficulties getting the protocol approved for actually giving healthy volunteers a disease? Isn't that something that doctors aren't allowed to do?
Ethics
guess always with the ethical approval, it's a question of, are the people going into it fully understanding all the risks involved, and are they signing up as informed consent? I mean, that's the absolute critical term in protocols. So informed consent, I mean, yeah, it's justified because of the gain, of the potential gain in the end.
I mean, it's an unusual situation. We normally give someone heart disease or cancer.
Right, exactly, yeah, yeah.
You give people common cold, so don't you?
I mean, it's just a question of, yeah, whether you think the person taking part in the trial genuinely knows what they're doing and what risks they're taking and entering into it. There's a lot of, there's whole research groups just looking at the ethics of trials, actually, Oxford Uni, so there's a lot of debate around that.
So,
on
the unrelated, get you off the ethics. What parasites has the plasmodium got? I mean, are there viruses or anything that it can be attacked with some biological component? And is there any way that its sexual behaviour can be abolished?
Good questions. No, I don't know of any sort of biological, natural predator, I suppose, of parasite, if you're thinking. Certainly there's been work on, like, fungus that grows on, that would attack the mosquito stages in the water and stuff, so sort of biological weapon against the mosquito, but I can't think of against the parasite itself. I mean, obviously, the human host mounts an immune response to it, so that in some cases it can't survive that. I don't know of any kind of biological mechanism.
So, resistant mosquitoes would be.
Right. Hence the whole kind of like sterile male resistance to malaria. I suppose you could argue that some of the species that don't transmit malaria may have evolved immunity to it, and that's why they don't transmit it now over time. So maybe there are species that exist but not in evolutionary succession.
I'm going to go to the back and then Barbara in front. Yeah.
Maybe a silly question. What if everybody in the entire world took an antimalarial, optimism or something, on the same day? Would we just eradicate it just like that?
That's
maybe a very silly question.
No,
and I know you'd have a lot of difficulty persuading or finding people out of Mongolia or Birmingham or somewhere to all take it on the same day, but it's a question.
As a hypothetical, I don't know.
And maybe you have to repeat it 2 weeks later as well.
So you have an issue exactly of which stage the parasite would be at, and then also vivax, of course, could be hiding in the liver, so you've got to think about perhaps a combination of drugs, ones that would kill that stage.
But if it was a one off, everybody would be done.
Well, no, you need to take into account the life cycle of the mosquito, because it's still the parasite is still in the mosquito.
That's
so the mosquito is going to live for a couple of days. You have to take it for long enough.
So that's why you have to repeat it.
Well, no, you have to keep it consistently for those number of days.
Yeah.
So I don't know how long the life cycle
is. Anyway, sorry. Rather than
how long is the life cycle of the mosquito? I mean, how long would you have to take it for?
The female can live for 2 weeks.
The very idea of getting people in the man
mountains of Ethiopia and the deserts of Mongolia to do at the same time with you.
You might not have to do the whole world, but maybe you could do the country.
No, but you would have to, because people that travel in and out, I mean, that's the whole issue. Movement these days is making such a difference in the more interested. Surely. Because I go to Tanzania tomorrow and I come out and I'm in Oxford with malaria.
You have to ban travel for 2 weeks.
You're on my way.
Stopping travel and vaccinating everybody.
There was some poor chap actually who was living near Heathrow, had never left Britain. And came in with malaria to the London School of Tropical Medicine because an infected mosquito had just hopped on one of the planes and avoided the spraying. And it survived just long enough to go and fight him. That was a bit of a mystery when he turned up.
Affection took a lot of time to get diagnosis from his
GP. Yeah, that's the trouble, yeah. We used to, Glasgow, we used to do a day with all the medical undergraduates.
I've come back from heavily malaria endemic areas and have taken some time to swear my GP that I've got malaria. So
yeah,
it takes some swearing.
Yeah, it's true. That's
any last contribution before we wrap up, Barbara?
Are there any skin lotions that would protect you against malaria?
Were you reading BBC News this week?
No.
There was a story about a cream that they found that was coated on the arms and put in cages of mosquitoes, and it completely repelled any bites. I mean, no mosquitoes and bit that person. So I thought maybe you
know that story.
Creams for as a repellent. Yeah, they exist. DEETs is, you know, the best one, basically. So if you're going to spray, make sure you've got DEETs in your high level.
Is it toxic to humans?
Well, it's been fully tested. But I mean, yeah, I wouldn't want to be spraying it every day, you know, for years if I lived in the country. It's for tourists. It's not really for the endemic population.
We've got country, I mean, the whole of Africa is, you know, at risk of malaria, and much of India and Pakistan and so on. And you can see how it's spread, but it seems to have jumped the sea.
Mm.
And especially South America versus Africa versus Zanzibar. How's that? I mean, and also in Southeast Asia,
yeah,
these islands. How on earth is it? Is it just people?
Boats. Boats.
Yeah.
Animals on boats.
There's
boats.
Yeah. There's two options. One is that the parasites have actually travelled physically through human beings and mosquitoes over the distance. But the second is that different populations of parasites have just genuinely evolved independently of each other.
Yeah.
And there's different schools of thought on different modes, depending on which drugs. They're definitely moving.
The
cargo ships. We have enough ships coming into England.
Well, I mean, on the main stage, malaria, because the weather is very similar to Morocco and North Africa.
Yeah, as I said, just all the other factors around reduced transmission. So just improved sanitation level and healthcare and access.
So it shows that it can be
malaria is preventable and treatable to death. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, that's the way to go. Get the African and South American people richer and away from the
nice.
Good point. You should say that, Matt, but it kind of hides the fact there are lots and lots of different resistant strains to resistant to different things. And South America is particularly famous for a strain of the parasite, which has got something called the Bolivian repeater, which is very resistant to a lot of the different drugs, and it's a certain bit of the genome which has been repeated causes a major change in a particular enzyme, which then makes it very, very resistant. And it's spotting things like that, and that's why sequencing in the genome project to try and sequence not just humans but other genomes. It's really small. Factually, the one thing you've got is a reasonably small genome in the malaria parasite, so it's doable and has been done. We're going to wrap up there, and please, we're going to have to clear up, so please do talk to Georgina and occupy her and entertain her while we're doing that. We're going to have a little bit of sitting out to do here. Thank you very much for coming to the first one, and hopefully we'll see you next month. You'll have seen on the tables that I put out some of these, which are the list of our next few talks. Nick Cooper is talking about what's Bray get up to when we're reading next month. That's Tuesday the 8th of October. Busy, busy week. So I may be on the prowl for people to help set up if all my students are busy doing freshers week. Fingers crossed that they're not. So we'll be back in here, and hopefully this will just grow bigger and bigger. And in the meantime, if you're not on the mailing list, I've not stupidly got enough flyers, but some out on the table back here. Please write to me on the different website, which you can have a look. If you are on the mailing list, you'll be getting the updates of what's coming on, and also the reminder on the next website as well. Thank you very much both to my students who've been helping, and ex-students, to the museum for putting us up, and a massive thank you to Georgina.